You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 544 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, joined today by Mr. Seth Miller. How you doing, Seth?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah.
Yes.
Just another summer day. We got some corrections, or I guess updates, on something we talked about last show with Landline. So I had mentioned that it looked like the schedule for Fort Collins to Denver had like gone away or was empty. Turns out they were just updating it. They're doubling down on Fort Collins. Like they're updating, adding more frequencies. But that partnership with United isn't continuing. So it'll just be an independent service from Fort Collins to, Denver International Airport.
And the Fort Collins one is outside security, right?
Correct.
And it always was. So that's. Yeah. It's interesting that I think has been one of the big debates of value of the program offering, whatever you want to call it, in that, you know, you have to arrive at the bus station or the airport theoretically earlier to clear security and you have minimum connect times. But if you're outside security, you still have a minimum connect time and you still have to clear security. And the theory, at least, is that you clear faster at the smaller airport.
Yeah. I mean, my coworker that uses the service, he wishes they could just clear it Fort Collins and make it a, but the thing is I think it makes multiple stops before it gets to FNL and then continues on to Denver. And I think there's just some complexities there with making it work.
You'd have to get everybody off at Fort Collins, clear them there, and then get them back on.
Yeah. So I don't think that's ever, I don't think that's in the plans. Maybe it is, but I don't think it's in the plans because of that complexity there. But I'm with you. Like I think clearing security there and then being a secure connection, one, I think it would help with just planning your trip. I think that's one of the things, like when you talk about connect times, you have to think about it. If you don't have, if it's not integrated into the airline, you've got to think about how long the trip takes. What if there's a problem with the bus?
Right. Like, does it become an unprotected connection, basically?
Exactly. Yeah. So
I've got one of those coming up next weekend. That's going to be a disaster. So I'm excited for it.
I mean, you live for that though, right?
I will get to that in a minute. While we're talking about Landline, though, South Bend is getting a Landline connection from American Airlines.
They are, yes, from Chicago, right, to South Bend?
Yeah.
So, I saw that. I mean, we could talk about it more in the bonus. We had it on the list in the bonus topics, but we can talk about it now. I don't care.
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah. That's a little bit of a hike, right?
It's about a two-ish hour drive, like right now on a Sunday morning when there's no traffic.
Yeah. That one, it's interesting to me. That's a little bit further than I would have expected them to use Landline just because of the distance, but it doesn't make sense to fly, I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's probably right on the edge. I'm checking now. Someone said they thought United flies it, and so I'm checking to see.
I think they do, or one of the little prop operators does.
Yeah. Yeah, United has it scheduled for the month of July 6 times a day.
Yep, on a CR2, I'm guessing.
50-seater, so yeah.
I guess maybe American just doesn't have 50 seaters to go around. I mean,
You know what, Steven? Sometimes a day it's actually on a 550. So with first class seats.
Wow. For that little hop, they don't even get up to cruising altitude on that one.
I'm just looking at the time. So arriving at O'Hare at 1:15 and at 6 a.m., 7:45. It was actually, those are going the other way. So yeah. The earliest flight and then the two that would feed the international departure banks to Europe are the 550s. Makes sense.
Yep. Here's what doesn't make sense about any of this. Like American will serve South Bend with a bus on a 2 hour drive, right? But they still serve Milwaukee on a CR2.
Yes.
And Milwaukee's an hour away and it's a straight shot.
Yes.
I don't know, man.
Yeah, I don't know. To your point about the stops on the way to Fort Collins, just making this all about me, my local bus station I have one around the corner from my house, but my bus goes from Dover to Portsmouth to Seabrook and then Logan.
Yep.
At Portsmouth, the park and ride facility that they use is literally at the end of the runway from Pease.
And they could just use Pease if they wanted to?
But it's a separate parking area. Like the parking area for Pease is at the middle of the terminal, so it's a mile and a half away by the time you sort of go up around the field and drive in. And it actually was an issue for me at one point. I would love if they would just have the bus pick up at Pease and clear there and drive in and be inside security at Logan. in theory, everybody except Terminal A at Logan is all inside the same secure area. So you just pick one place to drop everybody off and you're fine. Except for Delta passengers. So, you know, screw them. And is it? No, it's just Delta. It's not Air Canada. So there's MB. Never mind. Yeah, except for Delta passengers. So fine. Maybe WestJet was over there, but I think that makes sense, but then would be, you couldn't stop in Dover or, Seabrook, which is just a little closer down the way. So it makes sense to me to try to do that. Also, like coordinating with P's to do it and process the extra capacity and whatnot. And you have to move a huge chunk of parking.
Yeah.
So, you know, win some, lose some, but it's annoying to me that I would love to clear security up here and have a protected connection.
Yeah. I mean, it's something where the airline is, you know, invested in you making it with the bus company. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway,
that's wild. I mean, that's kind of why what my thinking is with Milwaukee. Like, why not offer a bus connection? You know, the CR2s, maybe I don't understand Americans' priorities. Yeah, it just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Are they really off CR2s? No, they're not. That's part of it.
No? E145s?
Americans got CR7s and E75 this month. United has some CR2s.
Yeah.
Some 550s and some 75s, depending on the day of the week and time of day.
Yeah, but I think about, like, the taxi times and everything to O'Hare. I'd rather sit in traffic on a bus.
Instead, you'd spend basically the equivalent of the amount of time you taxi after landing?
Yeah. It's insane. I mean, it would help with the traffic at O'Hare on the taxiways. So,
multimodal, man.
Yeah, yeah. Last mile or last hour, you know.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Avelo and Breeze. So, Avelo on the West Coast is basically shuttering operations.
Completely. Yeah, they're out by the first week of December.
And you had a post about this, and your theory is it's less to do with the. Their deportation flights that they're doing, and more to do with just finances in general?
Well, I think where I come down on this is we don't really know, which of course we don't, because, you know, businesses that don't like to say things in public, whatever. You know, like all other businesses, airlines lie about what their profits are right up until the moment they shut down a hub. Thanks, Cleveland. So, but anyways, right, like there was a lot of talk about them shutting this down and, you know, things shrinking and one of the interesting bits of data I went and pulled is sort of just overall schedule volume. And from Q3 to Q4 of last year, they pulled back significantly on the West Coast. And you have to remember, right, like their operations are either East Coast based planes or West Coast based planes. They don't really flow things through.
Yep.
So I basically searched, use Cirium data, and basically split everything west of the Mississippi, east of the Mississippi. Gets a little complicated because Houston, Dallas, and New Orleans are served on the east of the Mississippi side. So you have to, whatever, back that data out. But they were cutting back traffic significantly at the end of last year. And so, you know, were you cutting in hopes of like cutting to the bone but still survivable or what? I can't really say. And, you know, did the deportation flights and the negative press around that further deteriorate things, or were they all already just like collapsing anyways? Hard to say for sure, but looking at the numbers, looking at the revenue, looking at a lot of those things, all signs point to the West Coast was pretty weak anyways. And it seems like given the financial challenges the airline was facing, enough that they closed Santa Rosa and started running the deportation flights anyways back in April, it sure seems like the economic situation was bad enough to begin with, and now it's just they finally gave up rather than, you know, maybe it was an orderly wind down, maybe it was something else, but it's hard for me to see this as being strictly tied to negative press around that stuff.
Hmm.
If that makes sense. Now, caveat there, it's really hard to see what loads are and what fares are for Q2 because that data is not well reported yet. All the data we had is up through Q1. And I'll tell you, I think we have some data from April, but, you know, and I had like TSA data for, you know, TSA data is current, but they share airport space with lots of airlines. So if you really want to only isolate them, you have to find airports only they fly from. And that's hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Like Santa Rosa was an interesting spot for them to kind of start with Burbank, I thought. Although we took that flight and it was fairly full, if I remember correctly, at the time.
I want to say it was quietish northbound impact eastbound, but or southbound. But
yeah, I only took it one level
on my return.
Yeah, yeah. I think Burbank. I mean, Burbank is an interesting. It's an interesting choice overall. I think Burbank traffic is that people want to go further from Burbank, and that's a challenging proposition, right? Because of weights and runways and everything. So they were kind of constricted to regional routes on the West Coast, and I think that's a harder sell maybe out of Burbank. I don't know. And to your point, though, I think some of the negative press did maybe impact them, but I think they also were already making that move. I think I think the writing was on the table, but I think the negative press definitely didn't help.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
And I was going to say that the other interesting half of it to me is Breeze, you know, a day later announced they're picking up six or seven of the routes. Five of the old routes and adding two more. And, you know, their usual Breeze through service and all this stuff. But Breeze really cherry picked.
Mm.
Right. Looking at the data of like the routes that Breeze picked, I think they picked four routes out of Burbank that Avella was bailing on of, you know, like the 10 or 12 that it has operated over the last 2 years. And all four were above average revenue performers.
Yeah.
Right. You have sort of reporting from the DOT data on average fare by route for Avello. And all of those were, you know, $3 to $8 above average, which doesn't sound necessarily like a lot, but, you know, in airline world, $3 to $8 is profit margin per passenger in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also Breeze is also not making money
at all. Like profitability at all.
So that Breeze, in its press release, said that it had operating profits for Q2 of 2025. We won't know exactly what that means until it reports its data to the DOT in a few months, because it's a private company, so it doesn't have, you know, earnings calls and whatnot. But that would be only the second quarter of operating profit it's had since its inception. And, you know, looking at the data as reported to the DOT, they've lost a ton more money than Avello has.
Hmm.
They just got way deeper pockets.
Yeah, yeah. I had this conversation with someone the other day about, you know, people, companies losing money, and they were talking about the WNBA, and I kind of made the comparison to airlines. I'm like, they lose money all the time, and no one seems to care, and they still pay their employees. Yeah, it doesn't make. I mean, I guess deeper pockets helps, but how long do you keep bleeding on some of these routes?
Well, and it's on certain routes, and just as a business overall. Fair questions. We really don't know. But yeah, not great. So I think what I would say is I think that Breeze has a better likely, you know, had deeper pockets, had way more money to begin with, and has Neilman at the helm, who, you know, for a variety of reasons is seen as a more compelling, you know, ability to raise future funds, if needed.
Yeah. And Breeze's routes don't start until March, so there's going to be a gap, right? In a 3 month gap between.
Yeah, I assume that has to do with Breeze needing to get some more airplanes delivered, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah. And then I guess one, I find it interesting. I think Salem, we think for Avello was
subsidized.
Did they just take that money and run, you think?
I'm guessing that it's paid out in chunks, and so they took what they got, but they won't get all of it.
Okay.
But I don't know for sure. One of the interesting things I'll say is the DOT filings are somewhat cryptic in terms of sort of the categories of what revenues and expenses are reported. But Breeze definitely reported certain subsidized route funding to the tune of, I want to say, $2 million, either a month or a quarter. I forget which of the reports it was on, but Avello didn't have that in its listings, although I thought some of their services were of the subsidized variety. So,
gotcha.
You feel bad for, you know, Salem Airport, because like the locals invested money to get the airport up and running.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, there's been people being employed to do this. And it was, I think it offered a service to those folks that didn't want to fly. They didn't want to fly to PDX. I mean, that was, they're like, I'm just going to Vegas, right? I just need to get to the LA area. It was a good way to do that. So I think it sucks in that regard, but we'll see. Maybe Breeze eventually brings it back. I think it's hard. Salem's an interesting airport and an interesting catchment area. So
yeah,
you got Eugene just down the road and they're being served. So
yeah. So isn't that one of the ones that got capped?
Yeah. Eugene's still on the list. So, and Salem's not truly halfway. It's like a quarter of the way, I guess. It's closer to Portland than it is to Eugene, I think. So
yeah, and I'm just see if I have the numbers here. Eugene was actually a pretty profitable market, sort of average fares Q1 2025. Looking at my graph here, it was somewhere around, you know, $90 or so average fare each way.
Yep.
Where Breeze's system average like $61. And what's the other one? Salem?
SLE.
Yeah, Salem was below average at like 58.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. And it is, I looked, it's pretty much exactly an hour to each from Salem. So, I mean, I would probably go to Eugene just because it's a smaller airport and a little more enjoyable. So,
yeah, the only other thing I'll throw out there, just that the data seems to show, is that Breeze is making up a lot. Breeze actually has lower average base fare than Avelo, but higher RASM and higher total revenue per passenger because they're making a more in ancillary stuff.
Mm, gotcha. Okay.
And I think that has to do with, because they've got the multiple products on board, they sell, you know, basic, good, better, best, blue, or blue, whatever it is. It's not blue, good, better, best. And they've renamed them now to all the, what the hell they called for their first classes. But nice or nicest. That's right. And then there was, you know, on top of that, the various other bits that are available. But anyway, nice or nicest. And nicest sort of includes the Ascent first class seat. It's a weird, but anyways.
It's great marketing, I guess.
Super easy.
Let's talk about Wizz Air and Abu Dhabi. What is...
Yeah, no more.
Why do you think they gave up on it?
Terrible economics, geopolitics. They also cited challenges with operating the XLRs in the hot, dusty environment of the Middle East, if I remember correctly.
Oh, that's okay. That's interesting.
Which, like, a little hard for me to believe, given that other airlines operate, I mean, admittedly not the XLR, but certainly next-gen Airbus Neo planes in that region. But yeah, there's also, I think Wizz has sort of for a while lost track of its initial key focus, which was trying to be Ryanair, but in Eastern and Central Europe. And as a result, Ryanair started moving in to displace Wizz Air in Eastern and Central Europe. And that's not great for Wizz. And they're having trouble controlling their costs and all those other things. And so, but, you know, they had, if I remember correctly, the Wizz Abu Dhabi was a shared investment with the with some locals, and they may have also just pulled the money out.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize Ryanair had made so many advances down there. But, I mean, it is kind of amazing how many flights they do have into the Middle East and Eastern Europe,
not Middle East.
That's what I meant. Yeah, sorry. It's super interesting to me. So, I guess maybe get back to your core competency.
Right. it's a big deal, right? Let's see if I can find some data on Ryanair's expansion in the Middle East, or excuse me, in Eastern Europe. They've grown a lot. Just using Cirium's definition of Eastern Europe, which I don't know what it is, but 67,000 departures in 2017, 142,000 for 2025, more than double of the last 8 years.
Wow.
They were growing fast. They were at 103 in 2022, 108 in 2023, jumped to 132 in 2024, and 142 this year. So, and of course,
that's a lot, man.
Yeah. I wonder how Wizz separates it out. Yeah. And Wizz actually, I assume this is because they've got too many different subsidiaries. They're actually smaller now in the Middle East than they were 2 years ago.
Hmm.
But now I'm going to try to add all the other brands in and see if that helps score the numbers. I'd not do that. If you put all the subsidiaries in, they're at 136,000, 137,000. But Ryanair's bigger than them now in Eastern Europe.
Wow, that's a big change. And is there enough value flying to the Middle East, specifically Abu Dhabi, for them to keep around? I mean, it sounds
theoretically the value prop was going to be low cost flowing people to Abu Dhabi, but also through Abu Dhabi into India and Southeast Asia, and that sort of brings us back to one of our conversations from last week about AirAsia and its XLR order and talking about being a network of low-cost carrier hubs. I think Wizz was has less experience running hub operations as opposed to point to point, while AirAsia understands hub operations a little better.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we mentioned or hinted at it in last week about sort of theories about a Middle Eastern hub happening. But Tony Fernandez, the what's his title, advisor or something, he's not the CEO anymore, of AirAsia, basically said, we are going to set up a Middle Eastern hub. We're getting rid of the 330s, which we'd also talked about a little bit last week, just size, trip costs didn't make sense for them. And he absolutely plans or expects that the airline will set up that hub in the Middle East. And then he actually also said he's going to sign one more 150 aircraft order and then get out of the business and retire. So we'll see if that actually happens. But also 150 aircraft order is massive. But and he likes to bandy about big numbers and big ideas. But, you know, for Wizz to be pulling out at the same time AirAsia is talking about extending in is a pretty interesting situation.
Yeah, I mean, it almost feels like the footprint of Wizz, it got out of control and it's unsustainable and they need...
Yeah, to but like, how does that get any better for AirAsia?
Yeah.
Also challenging is, if I remember correctly, a big part of this is trying to get service into and out of India.
Mm-hmm.
And move people through. And so for AirAsia, that is less of a thing because most of its capacity is to the east of India as opposed to the west. And so you won't fly via Abu Dhabi to get, or the Middle East anywhere to get back to Southeast Asia. They might, they obviously are thinking about extending further west and northwest from the Middle East. So some of that would make sense. But if I remember correctly, there's limits on number of airlines, number of seats from India to the UAE. Or any Middle Eastern country. And that's why you have things like Indigo's, all of its code shares and some of the wet lease stuff that they're doing, right, with Turkish, what they were doing with Turkish, that's over now, or dying now. Or getting, like, capacity from Emirates into the various Indian cities, and, like, they can only do so many seats, so they have to be careful about where they put them. And they can't just put A380s everywhere, trying to protect Indian airlines. And so... You know, could AirAsia finally, you know, suddenly find itself a partner with Air India Express flying people to the Middle East too? I don't know, but there's some weird stuff going on there about where the passengers are and where the expansion could be. I think.
Yeah. Super interesting. The other thing we should talk about is Aegean's XLRs. Speaking of XLRs,
yeah,
Aegean's getting more, I guess.
Aegean is getting two XLRs at the end of this year, one in December, one in January.
Okay.
Last July or April or something like that, they announced an order for four LRs. And the four LRs were going to be their first planes with lie-flat seats. They were going to expand their market, talked about serving India, talked about serving a bunch of other areas. Africa, good stuff. Fine, great. All of a sudden, last week, an announcement, oh, by the way, we're going to have two XLRs in service early next year. I think they said... Delhi will be 5x weekly in March, and Mumbai will be 3x in May, based on expectation of when these planes are going to deliver. And it was sort of a like whiplash bit of, wait, what? How did this happen? You know, record scratch kind of thing. And one of the interesting bits they noted is that the aircraft will be configured with 24 business class bed lie-flats and 114 economy seats for a total of 138. Which is a very premium heavy configuration that happens to match JetBlue's aircraft layout. And then I went back and did some digging. JetBlue had three XLRs due in 2025 when it suspended its order for them, or deferred its order. And that was last July. And so the situation I'm thinking is that these two were basically had already gone into the production phase. Because it's usually 18 to 24 months out that like Airbus and all the suppliers say, okay, you know, we're starting now. Do you have everything lined up? And, you know, the final assembly doesn't take that long, but getting the fuselage components ready to be put into the final assembly line takes a while. Getting the wings built and delivered to the final assembly line takes a while. Seats, it's all of that stuff. And so I think basically what happened here is that JetBlue actually had a couple that had started that process when it went to do its deferral. And Airbus resold them to Aegean. So, you know, sort of good news for Aegean of like, oh, yeah, we could get a couple early. And they seem very excited to start their India service earlier than expected, because originally they were expecting to get the LRs at the, I want to say at the end of 2026 into 27, and now it's sort of 27, 28 based on delays from Airbus. So this was a couple planes that they could get their hands on very quickly, which is a big win. I'll also say I was talking to John Walton actually about this a little bit, and one of his comments was, but also kind of an interesting to note that like an airline that already has XLRs and whatnot couldn't grab these probably because they couldn't get fresh interiors delivered in time. Whereas it seems like Aegean is just taking the JetBlue interior and obviously, you know, everything's blue. So that's okay, I guess. They'll have to like, you know, take the JetBlue branding specific stuff out, but
fit and trim should be similar.
I mean, it's interesting that Airbus is like, here's, we already have these almost done airplanes. Do you want them? And Aegean's like, sure.
Right. I mean, well, MTUs not taken up is a thing. And they had it with, I want to say Qatar Airways had a bunch of untaken Maxin that, or took Maxin or something like that. All the Chinese planes that Boeing redistributed elsewhere, a lot of those went to India. 737 Maxes, like the Russian 350s that were delivered contractually and then undelivered in the end of, in 2023 when the invasion of Ukraine broke out. Those ended up in Turkey, if I remember correctly. Like, it happens perhaps more than it should.
Yeah, that's wild.
What was the 748s that are going to be Air Force One were Russian NTUs, right?
I think so. And then they went to Qatar and then to...
Well, no, not that one. But
oh, well.
The real
Air Force. Oh, the actual ones, yeah. I think you're right.
I think they were designated for Transaero, no.
Transaero operates them, or they operated 744s, yeah.
Yeah, so I think they were going to be Transaero 748s and then, like, went bankrupt or whatever, and Boeing was stuck with them and then managed to resell them to the United States.
I was going to say, we had a Patreon comment. I think it was Lee, maybe? It sent us a note and was asking, he was specifically asking about some of the stuff around, you know, Middle East carriers putting, you know, J suites on 737s and stuff and Airbuses and looking at now this XLR order. Like, is this going to become more common when, you know, United starts flying more 737s across the Atlantic?
United's going to be XLRs across the Atlantic and Max 10s for Transcon. But yeah, I mean, this is, it's not new. Like, Fly Dubai has had flatbeds on, I want to say it's 737s for several years now. We've been talking about single aisle flatbed options. And as the XLR and LR especially extend the range available, yeah, there's going to be a lot of flatbeds on single aisle planes.
Yeah. And I mean, the Max 10 is an interesting one because, like you said, it's on premium, you know, let's say premium Transcon routes. They could technically use it across some of the Atlantic or like to Nook or.
Nook, they could do it. And I mean, I'm sure probably Newark to
Funchal
in Ireland also, like the shorter stuff, but it's got a shorter range than the 8.
Yep.
Or the 9. So it's a, but it's a bigger plane. So there's a trade off there.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, I think we definitely should expect to see more flatbeds on single aisle planes. Now, it's going to be because flatbeds fly long distances. And, you know, I as I was reading about the JetBlue stuff and sort of running my due diligence to make sure I really was the right layout that matched, I reread one of my reviews of flying their transatlantic in coach and was reminded that, you know, you could claim it feels more crowded or whatever because it's not a wide body plane. But the reality is the individual seat space is larger on a 321 than it is on a 350 or 787.
Just because of the way the cabin is configured. And
yeah, with the, I should say on a 777 or a 787 because of seat width, and 350, it's touch and go.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it's, or 330 Neo, similarly touch and go. Like the, you get more space on a, on that 320, on especially the JetBlue one, because it's a lot of leg room than you do on a wide body.
Yep. And for Spirit, they're entering a new partnership, I guess, for Macon, Georgia.
So they announced this partnership with Contour Airlines a couple months ago, and it was this sort of, we're going to let Contour do ground handling for us at a bunch of airports where it already operates, and we'll fly in some mainline planes, and it'll be better for everybody. Contour handles essential air service routes, yeah. So basically stuff subsidized by the U.S. government, sort of guaranteed to not lose money. And so Macon, Georgia is one of those places. Currently, you can fly Contour from Macon to Dulles and connect from there onto United's network. And Spirit is going to start flying in October twice a week from Macon to Fort Lauderdale. It's up there.
Huh.
And it's super interesting. It's not a subsidized service. So then, you know, partly becomes a question of, does showing demand for real commercial service, you know, chip away at the subsidized routes? Do they find ways to run the network sort of separately enough that there's not demand in both places? I don't know.
But I mean, are they only using Contour for the ground handling? They're not going to like use them for serving. Like, wouldn't they feed something to Spirit?
That's what I originally thought it was going to be, but no, they seems to just be a ground handling thing.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I don't know why. Like, I don't know how that's a strategic partnership, but sure. Next up, thought those.
And then Gulf Air, they got 12 787s
plus six options. The Bahrain's finance minister was visiting and picked up some toys to take home to the family.
So do they have 12 deliveries coming? Did they say when?
These orders are, I don't remember the timing on the orders. They're not too far out, but they're not immediate, if that makes sense. Like, it's end of the decade sort of situation.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. Kind of talk here, but yeah, good to have an option. They had some on order already.
Yeah. I mean, some quick people had asked the question around the Middle East airlines in general, specifically, you know, Etihad, Oman Air, and Gulf Air, because there's so many carriers down there that it's hard to know like what's a useful carrier. I guess that sounds bad, but like the carriers of convenience versus the carriers that are big carriers. And Gulf Air is not a big carrier, right? They serve, I don't know, 30 destinations, 40 destinations, maybe. I guess they serve more than, maybe they serve more.
It says
than
50 now in the press release, and they have 77s in service. But yes, they are a small airline, all things considered.
Yeah, and like they're coming back to JFK in October. So, like, there will be U.S. service. There was Houston service for a while, and it ended. But, like, the reach of some of these carriers is not that great. And I think maybe Oman Air is less so than Gulf Air. But they're taking deliveries of planes. I guess they have to, right? To be relevant and to stay up to date with the latest. So interesting. 12 787s. I'm guessing they're replacing some birds. What do they? They have A340s, I think.
Yeah, and growing a little bit. What was the other one you said? Gulf Air, Oman Air. Who was the other one you named?
What was the other one I named? Etihad.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I wonder what their current quarter. Etihad has 26,000 departures, Gulf Air's 13,000, Oman Air's 10,000. Yeah, there. And interestingly, double the number of departures for Etihad Airways, but like 6x the number of ASMs. They're much bigger planes flying longer.
Hmm. Yep. Wow. Something to think about. What else we got? Condor is getting some A330neos.
Yeah, some more. They've got, you know, a pretty big fleet. They did that conversion or migration of their fleet from, I want to say, 767s to 330neos and put the like fancy business class in. It became a really nice product. Despite losing its feed in Germany from Lufthansa, they seem to be keen to keep growing. And so, four firm, four options, potentially a fleet of 25 total by 2031.
Smaller airlines are growing just like big ones.
I'm supposed to be on them in August. Everyone has told me they are an operational nightmare. Like multiple people.
Yeah. I think they are similar to Turkish Airlines. When it goes well, it goes great.
And when it goes bad, you're stuck somewhere for 12 hours.
Oh, 12. That's cute. Yeah. Good luck with that. I would check your travel insurance policy.
Great. Perfect. JFK is a dump, literally, or I guess it took a dump. Did you see the story?
I'm looking at the headline and not sure I actually want to bother clicking in.
So apparently raw sewage dropped onto the luggage at Virgin Atlantic's gate or their baggage claim area. And so people's luggage was just covered in raw sewage.
Lovely.
I would just burn it at that point. It's a loss.
Yeah.
Like, just leave it at the airport. I'm not even going to touch it.
Do you even pretend to clean it? I don't even know what you do there.
I don't want it in my car. I just let the airport deal with it. It's a bad.
Right, but as the airline, how do you even deal with it?
I don't know. Hazmat suits.
Yeah. Nasty.
And then a listener to the show, Sina, has asked us to comment on the story, I guess it's making a lot of buzz around it, with Delta moving towards eliminating set ticket prices and using AI to determine how much you're going to pay for a ticket.
Yeah. So this is both real and isn't, I think, in a lot of ways. Right. So we're separating out. So this comes from Delta announced a partnership with a company called Fetcher, with two R's at the end. So, you know, good luck for finding it online. It's an Israeli based company that does revenue management through AI, and is basically what Ed Bastian, I think it was Ed, said in, like, again, in the latest earnings call, is we want to find the right price to sell to a person at that seat on that plane at that time, what will a passenger pay? Which theoretically is sort of a holy grail of merchandising, right? They want to charge as much as they can for the thing that they are trying to sell to maximize their revenues and profits. Where it gets interesting is specifically trying to target different fares for the person, you know, for the exact same seat at the exact same time of sale, depending on who is doing the buying. And so this is something that airlines have been talking about for a long, 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 long time. I came across a post the other day on LinkedIn, someone saying, yeah, if depending on your zip code, airlines will feed you a different price. And that's, I have not actually seen that happen yet. What I have seen is lots of airlines talking, like Delta is, about investing in technology that might one day be able to do it. And Delta says that 3% of its domestic capacity is using this system right now. It was at 1% at the beginning of the year. So they are slowly growing it, slowly feeding more data into it, giving it more routes to manage. But it's, I don't think we're there yet. Despite people claiming, right, this is like the, like, you always have to buy tickets in incognito mode, because if you search the same route three times, your fare goes up. Never actually been demonstrated as true. And airlines keep saying they would love to be able to do that, but can't yet. So, like, good on you for trying, folks, but the airlines aren't there yet. I do believe that they will theoretically get there eventually. And a big part of that is NDC, right? They're going away from traditional fare classes, fare buckets, and inventory, and moving to a much more dynamic, bids and offers, where I say I want a ticket and they come back and say, okay, this is how much it costs. And so for a long time, the industry has sort of been building the infrastructure to be able to do it. The hard part has been getting the technology on the back end to be able to differentiate at the time that that query comes in and say, oh, it's Seth, and he's a business traveler, and he always flies out on Monday and back on Thursday, and has been doing it for, you know, the last 8 months, so let's put another $10 on it and see if he actually keeps paying, because those are the flights he always takes.
I agree. I kind of agree with you, I guess. I feel like even that might be impossible for the airlines.
Because, I'm not saying I think they can do it, but I'm saying I think they're trying.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're going to try. I think it's not going to go as well as they think.
And it might not be. Let's assume it's not going to be to the level of Seth, you know, Seth versus Steven buying at the same time in place, but maybe it's, you know, top elite versus lower tier elite, or based on historical, you know, trailing 12 month spend, which is something the airlines definitely track, right? We know American uses that for upgrade priority.
Yeah, I think so.
Right. And so part of it is getting that data sort of into the real time pricing of fares versus batch runs of things like upgrades. And it's much more complicated to do it real time. And fare generation of sort of these bids and offers things, like, it's already hard just with fare buckets and inventory and fare rules. Trying to get now into the nuance of individuals is going to make it way, way harder.
And I think that's, I mean, maybe that's where my doubt is like, they have a hard enough time dealing with fare rules. Like,
yeah,
just dealing with the basics of a ticket.
They have a hard enough time doing with published fares. There's mistakes all the fucking time.
Well, yeah. And so why don't you, I mean, you're going to have to beat that one out. I think the complications of adding AI, and I'm doing air quotes for people who can't see me, is it's not non-trivial. Like, there's actual work that has to be done. The other piece I find interesting is, like, Delta's hinting at you have to be logged in to utilize to get a price, and I'm like, that's not going to work over time. Like, how are you going to sell via third parties if you require a login to do that? And I think it comes back to your point. It's like, they're trying to track you based on your spend or your history. I like, maybe that works for direct sales. Some of that works. But I think, being a travel agent is impossible.
Well, and this is where the NDC thing comes in. If you've got travel agents that are using NDC connections instead of GDS connections, so NDC's new distribution capability, I think is what it stands for. And this is the sort of highly dynamic built-in direct connections as opposed to the global distribution systems, the GDSs, the Sabres, the Apollo.
Amadeus.
Is Apollo even a thing anymore? All of those legacy giant systems that are, for better, more or less anonymous. Right? I say I want a ticket, you tell me how much it costs, and then I decide if I want to buy it, as opposed to a general request comes in for a ticket and a pricing comes back, and then they figure out who the person is afterwards. And I see this, when I'm logged in to buy a ticket for myself, getting offers of like, hey, do you want to buy lounge access on your international trip when you already have elite status that's going to give it to you? Well, thanks. That was pretty terrible personalization. Good luck. Try again next time. Right? Like, airlines are bad at this stuff already, but they think they're getting better. So.
Yeah.
Delta seems to think it's working, right? They're growing it. They're going to try. But, and to your point, yes, if I have to be logged in to buy tickets, like that is going to dramatically change the way the industry functions and probably for the better as a consumer.
I mean, it's something Delta's bragged about in the past, which is we've got all these people as part of, our elite program.
Yeah.
You're just going to. Force that issue if you do that. And I don't think that goes great for folks.
I will also say, right, like look at the history of Southwest Airlines. They only sold direct.
Yeah.
Or through corporate. But and now it's not entirely that, and they are metasearch engines, but you could, for a long time, they had enough of a halo around the business that people wanted to buy Southwest. They went to Southwest, they bought Southwest. Delta gets a sizable portion of direct sales these days. And so even if it's only that chunk that gets converted and everybody else is on sort of generic GDS fares. And what's to say that the GDS fares won't end up being higher because, they only sell higher fare buckets to the public and they're willing to sort of write off some of that traffic towards in exchange for pushing people towards direct channels. Like you have to renegotiate some contracts, I think. And I'm not sure that the GDSs will let them do it that I just described, but that I could imagine some push towards that direction as well.
Yeah. I should find the post. There's another post. Someone posted something on Facebook about, and I think it's kind of spam, but they're like talking about, well, I used AI to get cheaper tickets. And, here's all the prompts you can use.
That's decidedly not true.
Exactly. And at some point, even if it is true, like eventually, let's say AI gets to the point where it can actually help you save money. We're just going to have AI bots fighting each other for cheap tickets. The future is grim.
See, the thing is, Stephen, AI is eventually going to know that you're getting tired because it's going to be reading and you're frustrated and see how many hours you've put in at work and know that you need a vacation. And it's going to figure out where you want to go based on posts that you've liked on social media, beaches or cities or things. And it's just going to book the tickets, submit your request for time off to your boss and order the car and pack your bags for you, I guess, too. But, it's going to be fine.
Like I said, the future is grim. And while it's doing all this, it's burning enough power to power a small city. So
I'd say mid-sized city, but sure. We should stop now.
Yeah, I'm bearish on AI. Can you tell? Anyway. All right. Anything else you want to talk about before we jump to the bonus topics, which includes grab-and-go lounges, some curfew stuff, JSX, we're going to talk about them, and then Miami being absurd on what an airport is. Anything else we have up for that?
No, I think we're good.
Cool. Well, Patreon subscribers, stick around for those stories. If you're not a Patreon subscriber, thanks for listening. We will talk to you next time. Happy travels.
Take care.